Let's renew our bodhicitta motivation, thinking that we want to learn and share the Dharma today for the long-term purpose of becoming fully awakened Buddhas. So we'll have the wisdom, compassion, and power and skillful means to be of the greatest benefit to all other living beings. Okay, so there's so much more to talk about karma, but no time today. So I wanted to just touch briefly on the other two aspects of wisdom. The third kind of wisdom, we started with the second, we'll do the third and then we'll come back to the first. The third kind of wisdom has to do with being wise, being skillful in caring for others. And in the Bodhisattva precepts, there's a list of 11 specific situations in which we should really, reach out and care for others as best as we can. Caring for others, helping others, does not necessarily mean we fix their problems. Okay, so we're not trying to be Mr. or Ms. Fix-It. Because sometimes, depending on the problem, what the person really wishes is simply to be heard. They want somebody to listen without interrupting and without criticizing. And sometimes when we can really be a good listener, that solves a huge part of the other person's problem. Yeah, because often the problem is they don't feel like people hear them or understand them. So learning how to be a good listener. There's many kind of techniques that we can do or learn about to do that. There's reflective listening. And I also recommend Marshall Rosenberg's Nonviolent Communication. That's very helpful for learning how to listen and engage with somebody who's experiencing difficulties. Other kind of problems, the kind of help people need is not for us to fix their problem by doing it for them, but by teaching them how to do it. And it's interesting because sometimes in working with others, we feel it's so much easier just to do it ourselves rather than have to explain it to somebody else and have them do it, and then they don't do it the way we want. So let's just do it ourselves. But that's not necessarily helping someone. Often the best thing is to show them how to do it. Yeah. And this goes for adults as well as children. Okay. Another way to benefit others is, as I was saying, to point out something that they do that we appreciate and to tell them why we appreciate. And I think for those of you with children, this is especially important. If you say to a child, oh, you're a good boy, you're a good girl, you're a bad boy, you're a bad girl, that doesn't tell the child anything useful, except that you're unhappy, and then they internalize that because you're unhappy, they must be bad. So that doesn't help at all. But if you say what the action was that they did and how that action helped you, that gives them useful information. I really appreciate your tidying up your room because now I can walk in it without tripping. Yeah? That tells the kids something useful. Yeah. I really appreciate your feeding the dog when I was late coming home from work, because that way the dog was happy and well fed. Yeah. So the specific, you know, thing that the child did, and this goes for adults too, you know, and how that affected you is a very good way of helping others. Okay? I know it was really inconvenient for you to stay 10 minutes late, you know, but I really appreciate it because it helped us finish the project on time. You know, something like that. So within the people that the texts point out to help are people who are sick, people who are injured. Yeah. And so here, to benefit them, sometimes we have to confront our own fear. Many people don't like going into the hospital to see a sick or injured relative or friend because, oh, maybe I'll catch something. Or because seeing somebody else who's sick reminds us of our own vulnerability to illness. Or seeing somebody else who's dying reminds us that we too will die. And that creates a lot of anxiety within us. So we need to work with our own anxiety. Yeah? And, you know, Buddhism really teaches us how to contemplate death, how to contemplate illness, so that it helps us in our practice. Yeah? Because if we remember that illness and death, not to mention aging, are you know, things that occur naturally in samsara, then that encourages us to do what we can to get out of cyclic existence. And how to do that, we need to eliminate ignorance, the ignorance that's the root. And how to do that, we need to study and meditate on and integrate into our lives the wisdom that realizes the ultimate nature, which I'll talk, which is the third kind of wisdom. So, hold on. And I think also, you know, when people are ill or injured, to remember how good they feel when others come and visit. Now, just a little tip in doing that. Sometimes when you go to visit somebody, they, you know, maybe their partner or their parent or somebody else is kind of standing at the door, how to say, regulating who comes in. And if you come on really strong to that person, you know, so-and-so's my colleague, I really want to see them, that doesn't go over so well. If there's somebody who considers themselves kind of the guardian of the ill or injured person's room or their availability, it can often be very helpful to acknowledge that person's special relationship with the person you want to see, and then ask if you can see them, rather than pushing or bullying your way in. So if your friend's mother is there, you know, you may say, wow, you know, you're so-and-so's mother. So-and-so's a really good friend of mine. You had a wonderful daughter, and you have a special relationship with her. You know, would it be okay with you if I went in and spoke with her for a short while? Yeah, if you say it like that, that's much better than, like I said, just coming in and saying, you know, I drove a half an hour to come see my colleague, and, you know, you're not letting me in to see them. Okay, that's not going to go over so well. Okay? We want to help people who are grieving. They may be grieving the loss of a relationship, the loss of their job, their loss of social status, their loss of finances, their loss of somebody they care about. You know, people can be grieving all sorts of things. And so when we, you know, when we want to reach out and help them, again, we have to tailor it for the specific individual, okay? If somebody is a Buddhist and you know they've been practicing, then you can give them Buddhist remedies, not remedies, but suggestions to help them with grieving, yeah? If a person isn't a Buddhist, or if they are but they're not, they haven't practiced a lot, then it's good to give other advice that can assuage their mind. One thing that I've found very helpful in speaking with people who are grieving is to say, to acknowledge their loss, to acknowledge their sadness, and to say, sometimes I do this just for people who are Buddhist. It depends, you know. Sometimes people who aren't Buddhist don't understand this so well. But I'll say something like, okay, to a Buddhist, what I'll say is, you know, I've realized that when we grieve, what we're often grieving is the lack of a future that won't happen. Because when you think about it, yeah, the past, we enjoyed that person's presence in our life. We can't recreate the past. The present, that person isn't here. We're not really mourning the present. But it's the future where we've had lots of dreams, aspirations, imaginations of having that person in our life. And now they've passed away and our dreams, aspirations, and so on, are not going to occur. So with some people, if I point that out to them, that what we're really grieving is the future that hasn't happened and may never have even happened the way we wanted to start with, sometimes that helps them see, you know, that exactly what it is that we're grieving. And then to suggest that, you know, although the person won't be there with us in the future, you know, as we would like, still we can rejoice that that person was in our lives for as long as they were in our lives. Yeah. And appreciate that we did meet them, appreciate what we shared, appreciate what we learned from each other. And then to send them on to their next life with our love, with our prayers, and so on. So often that gives people something, a new way to look at their loss, and also something to do, yeah, by doing recitations and making aspirations that they then, for the welfare of the deceased, and sending them on with the love and those prayers. Okay. Sometimes, you know, depending where somebody is on the grieving process, you know, what they do need is a casserole. But what my friends have often told me is that you get casseroles for about 2 weeks, and then everybody forgets about it, and they're back to normal. And they kind of forget that for you, you know, it was something, it was a very deep loss. So often when people are grieving, wait 2 weeks, 3 weeks, then send them a casserole. Okay. Or better yet, instead of a casserole, give them some variety. Yeah. Yeah, send them some food they like. Invite them out to dinner. Because often they're still grieving after 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. But we aren't grieving the person they lost anymore. Okay? So they need that kind of support for a while. Another thing that I found helpful with when somebody has died is for the friends and relatives to gather together and just talk about the person and share their memories. And I remember when my mother died, someone had us do that. My mother was quite a character. So we were telling stories and laughing at what my mother would do that she thought she could pull off and get away with. And it was really very, very helpful and healthy for all of us to share those stories. Yeah? And with another friend, I was with his family after he passed away. And again, you know, his adult children were telling stories about their dad when they were young. And his wife was telling stories, and his best friend was, you know, we all shared our stories. And this was brought us all together, bonded us together, knowing that we were all grieving the same person, even though we had different relationships with him. So it brought about a sense of understanding and a way to share and to honor that person's life. Okay? Those are just some suggestions if you're helping someone who's grieving. Okay? Other people to help? People who are depressed? Yeah? Or people who have some mental problems? Here, it's, if you're not a therapist, don't try and be one. Yeah? If you can clearly see that somebody has a problem where a therapist would be more effective in helping them, help them find a therapist that would be suitable for them. Okay? Refer them to therapy. Often, you know, sometimes when somebody has problems, they come to us for advice, and we say something, and let's say we're not trying to be Mr. or Miss Fix It, or maybe we are, because they always, well, let me back up. Usually when people ask for advice, they say, what do I do? This and such happened, what do I do? And I always say, let's wait on what you do. Let's work with what your emotional and mental state is right now. Because first it's important to become calm and peaceful, resolve your emotional state, balance it out. And then after you've done that, it's easier to see what to do. Okay. Often people want to act without being in touch with what's going on, what we were talking about this morning. Yeah. So some feelings going on, you don't know what your motivation is, you have some idea what to do, you think doing the action will solve the inner turbulence, it doesn't. Yeah. So it's helpful to encourage people to solve their inner turbulence and then look at what to do. Yeah. Sometimes people, they don't even go there. They just want, what do I do? What do I do? So you might give a suggestion and they say, yes, but da 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 da. And they explain to you why they can't follow your suggestion. So then you give another one and they say, oh, that's good, but da 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 da. I give people two yes buts. I should probably only give them one. Yeah, definitely not three. But if we're not careful, we can be giving 10 yes buts and on the phone with them for 4 or 5 hours. So if somebody is saying yes but, then I think a good way to help them is to say, you know, you're a very intelligent person, and you know the situation better than I do. What do you think might help? And so to encourage the person to look inside and get in touch with what they think might help. And hopefully in the process, they'll realize, whoa, first thing I have to do is calm down. Okay. But it doesn't do a yes but person any good to keep giving more and more suggestions. Yeah. Because they just keep saying yes, but. Okay. So it's also good to look at when we get into yes but. Now I know none of you do that. It's only those other people who do that. But once in a while maybe we slip up. Yeah. So to really look at when, you know, we get stuck in yes, but. Yeah. Okay. Help travelers. It's another group of people to help. Tourists, travelers, people who are lost. Yeah. In some countries where you go, if you stop a stranger and you say, how do I get so-and-so, get to this and that place, they'll actually walk you there. Or they'll say, follow me, and, you know, they'll lead you there. Americans don't tend to do that. I think it would be nice sometimes if we had the chance. You know, when people are in our state or in our country and they don't know how to get to a place where they need to, if we have the time, if it's a nearby location, to actually escort them there and show some friendship. If not, draw them a map, okay? Show them how to use the GPS that's in their rental car. They may not know how to use that. Okay. Give them suggestions of routes and landmarks. And wish them well. Okay. If you've ever been traveling in another country, you'll know how wonderful it is to meet somebody who really cares about your being lost. Yeah, and how much you appreciate it. If you don't know how to get where they're going, don't just say, I don't know. That's much better than saying, I think it's 2 blocks to the west, while you're thinking it may actually be 2 blocks or 4 blocks to the east. Yeah, I've been in situations where I've been lost. People don't want to say no. So they give you some direction. Oh, please, just tell me you don't know. That's much better. Okay? And then I'll ask somebody else who hopefully does know. Yeah? If you're traveling in an airport and you see somebody who's in a wheelchair who needs help, or somebody from another country who doesn't know how to read all the, you know, instructions to find their next flight, help them out, accompany them to the gate where they need to go. This is so appreciated. Situations maybe in a supermarket where you see a parent with a child who's screaming, or an airplane with a parent and a child who's screaming. Yeah. It can often be helpful to go up and just offer the parent some empathy and maybe sometimes distract the child. Sometimes the child is so shocked by a stranger coming up that they just stop, you know. And look, sometimes that makes them cry louder. So you have to be sensitive. Okay? Or sometimes maybe you can help the parent out by doing something they need to do. Why the parent maybe takes the child outside, or, you know, because often changing the environment for a crying baby is very helpful. I'm sure you parents know that better than I do. I once sat next to a woman who had a a child who was crying off and on. And I wound up holding that child for most of the flight. You know, the mother was exhausted. So I held the child and I played with the child and, you know, and the baby was okay. So, you know, there's different ways to reach out and help people. What are other groups? Yeah? Do you have ideas? What other kind of groups of people is important to reach out to?
Elderly.
Thank you. Yes, elderly, for sure. Thank you very much. I always marvel at how little we respect the elderly in this culture, because I've always found it very interesting talking to elderly people, because they were alive during events in history that I just read about, and it's so interesting to talk to them about what it was like to live through that. Yeah, it's fascinating. Or to ask an elderly person, you know, to say, you've lived a long time, what have you learned about life that's valuable, you know? And for us as somebody who's younger, what can we learn from the experiences of the elderly that would really help us in living life? So to show respect to the elderly, to help them when they want help, and not help them when they don't want help. And I say this because my dad did not want me to help him get in and out of cars. He did not want me to help. But when my friends came to visit me when I was visiting him, he loved when they helped him in and out of cars. So whenever we were going out someplace with my friends, I would step back. They would help Dad in and out of the car. And he was very happy because he loved the attention, but not for me. Okay. When he had an accident, he did not not a car accident, a pee-pee caca accident. You know, he didn't want me around. Yeah. He wanted his caregiver to help him. Or my sister, my younger sister, actually. He didn't want me. So you have to, you know, ascertain in different situations when you're the right person to offer help to the elderly and when you're not. Okay? Because some elderly people like the help because they realize that they're fragile and so on, and others don't. The hardest thing with the elderly is to convince them not to drive. I can see some nodding heads. Woo! Yeah, my mom was good about that. She just realized that she needed to stop driving. Dad, on the other hand, you know, for him it was a loss of autonomy. It was a loss of his being the person who drove in the family. And all three kids got around and we pleaded with him. We gave him every reason in the book. We said, you've driven your whole life. Let's let somebody else drive you now. Oh, it was so difficult convincing him not to drive. So you have to realize in those situations that you have to convince them in a way that does not make them feel like they're old and incapable of driving. Because that's one of the things they're grieving as they age is, you know, their social standing as the parent of the family and their feeling of capability and their independence. So we have to somehow, I don't have the magic touch for this one, figure out how to say it to them so that they feel loved and valued, not so that they feel incompetent. Mm-hmm. And this goes as well for friends who are not very good drivers, who want to drive you around. Yeah. To just volunteer to drive and do that. Okay. What other groups? Yeah.
Disabled.
Yeah, the disabled. Okay. And again here, being sensitive when somebody needs help and when they don't need the help, it's just taking them a little bit longer to do it. Yeah. And you know, it's really sometimes touch and go because you don't know how somebody's going to react. When I was in Denmark last spring teaching, I was taking a walk with a friend one day, and there was one disabled man in a wheelchair trying to cross the street, but the curb was there. He couldn't get up or he couldn't get down. I forget what it was. And, of course, the light's going to turn red. So we immediately went over and helped him with that part of his journey to get him up the curb or down the curb, whatever it was. And then it was clear he could take over from there. Yeah, he needed help with that. He didn't want help that went beyond that, you know, because he needed to feel like he was capable. So same, you know, in all the situations with disabled people. And also I think what's very important with the disabled, is don't stare at them. Yeah, this is what they often say they don't like, is people turn around and go like this and stare at them. Don't stare, you know? They're having a hard time walking or whatever, but they're managing. It's just taking them longer. No problem. Yeah? Or somebody's disfigured in some way or another. We don't need to stare at them. We can smile at them. They often appreciate smiles. Yeah, everybody appreciates smiles. Okay. Sometimes asking, you know, do you need help, is good rather than just jumping in and starting to do something. Because they may say, no, I'm okay. Hmm? Other groups? Anything else? Yeah.
The poor, the sick, and the terminal.
What was the last one?
Poor.
Terminal. Okay. So the poor. Oh, here's a good one with the poor. I don't like giving money because I don't know what the money's going to get used for. Yeah? And especially if somebody has a drug alcohol problem, I do not want to support that. But everybody needs to eat. So it's good to give food when you can. Sometimes you'll see when you're walking down the street, or sometimes on street corners there'll be people with signs. And so I try to give them a granola bar or an apple or, you know, give them some food. That's always good. When somebody's sitting down on the street, you know, often with the poor and with the homeless, what hurts them more is the disrespect that people give to them, kind of walking past and not acknowledging them, or being rude, like, can't you get your life together, you're homeless. One man told me a story. He was in Berkeley. As you know, there's lots of homeless in the street in Berkeley. And there was one woman who was panhandling. And he had like a dollar. He didn't have much. And so he you know, bent over and looked at her, looked her in the eyes and said, "I don't have much, but I want to give this to you and I want you to be happy." And she started to cry. And she said, "You know, that's what you said and how you looked at me was the kindest thing that you could have done." You know, because so often these people, what's so valuable to people is just respect, to be treated as a human being like you would treat anybody else. Yeah, whether they're on the street, whatever's going on, you know, to look people in the eyes, to talk to them in a respectful way. That is like honey for somebody. And I do work with inmates. They're another group of people. And again, the thing that I find most valuable in working with the inmates is just that if I correspond, I just talk to them like I would talk to anybody else. I try to help them, so I ask questions and discuss different things with them. But I also, the tone of the letters isn't like, you know, "Gee, you're a criminal, such a slob, you can't get your life together." It isn't like that. It's, here's a person who made an unwise choice, very often because they were intoxicated, yeah, but now they're trying to turn their lives around or at least survive living in prison, because prison is not a pleasant place. So to treat them with respect. And when I go and do prison visits, again, to talk to the people with respect like I talk to anybody else. Because you don't realize that in prison they're so disrespected. The whole system disrespects them. The guards, the staff don't treat them well. And very often inmates with each other don't treat each other very well. So somebody just treating them like they're just a regular person, which is what they are, does so much more than, you know, all sorts of other things that you could do. I don't get involved with the inmates' families or their personal cases. I will if it's somebody I've known a long time and I've seen change in. If they ask me for a recommendation for a parole letter, I will write that, and I write the letter honestly. I don't skew it one way or the other. Okay, other groups we need to touch on. But one last closing comment about this is, when we want to help others, what is often the best thing to give is just who we are. It's not learning a technique. We often go places to learn techniques. Yeah. If you don't have a kind heart, your technique doesn't do any good. Yeah. So the most important thing is to have a feeling of kindness within ourselves and a feeling of equality with whoever we're helping, because nobody likes to be looked down upon. Okay. Now, the third kind of wisdom is the wisdom knowing the ultimate nature. So we'll do this one really short. The way things appear to us in the world, they appear to us to be objective things existing outside, independent of our mind. And in fact, they don't exist objectively out there, separate from our mind. In the same way, when we think of ourselves, we feel like there's a real, objectively existing person in here. And that's not really how we exist either. Okay, now, why should we be concerned about this? What difference does it make? Because, as we've researched, you know, when we experience unpleasant things and suffering, it's due to our negative karma. Why? What? Where does our negative karma come from? Mental afflictions, such as confusion, attachment, jealousy, anger, vengeance, arrogance, those kind of mental afflictions. What's the root of all those mental afflictions? It's ignorance. What is ignorance? What are we ignorant of? And how does ignorance apprehend things? We're ignorant of the dependent nature of phenomena, and we're ignorant of the fact that because things exist dependently, they don't have any kind of objective or inherent existence from their own side. So if we can generate the wisdom that understands that emptiness or lack of inherent existence or objective existence, independent existence, then we can overcome the ignorance that misapprehends how things exist. If we can overcome that ignorance, then the greed, the clinging attachment, resentment, jealousy, arrogance, and so on that come out of that ignorance, those confusing emotions are overcome. When we no longer have those emotions or wrong views, then we stop creating the harmful karma. Okay, and in fact, we stop creating any karma that causes rebirth in cyclic existence. When we can do that, when we stop creating just the negative karma, then we create a situation where we'll have good rebirths in the future. When we're able to stop creating all karma, polluted karma, then we're able to gradually stop rebirth in cyclic existence altogether and attain our spiritual goals of liberation and full awakening. So to understand, when we talk about the emptiness, it does not mean that nothing exists. This is quite important. It doesn't mean nihilism, nothing exists. It means that the way things appear to us at present and the way we mistakenly apprehend things to exist, that doesn't exist. But things do exist. Okay? In the sense that things appear to us right now to be independent, to not depend on any other factors. And even when we think of ourselves, we appear to ourselves to be an independent entity. I'm here. Here I am. This is me. We don't question what the word I refers to. Or who is this me? Okay. We just assume that it's some real concrete thing that's really there. And this gets us in trouble, because when we feel like there's a real me, I mean, I'm sitting here and there's a real me, that means that I am going to see the world in terms of help and harm. I'm attached to what I like and what seems to benefit me. I want to get rid of what I don't like and what interferes with my happiness. And so creating that me an other, creating that I like, I don't like, I want, I don't want, puts me always in conflict with other living beings because I have to protect myself because there's this real me here. So if we were able to see ourselves in a different light as a being who's dependent, we depend on a body and mind, we are not, you know, we're changing all the time. We're dependent on causes and conditions. Yeah, we're dependent even on having the conception I. Yeah. So the more we can see ourselves as dependent, then that helps us recognize that we are not independent, self-enclosed entities. Okay? It helps us to see the emptiness of that independent existence of both ourselves and all other people and all other phenomena. When we see things as dependent, our mind relaxes a lot. Okay? Especially regarding ourselves, we realize, you know, there's no big concrete I there that needs to be protected. Wow! Wouldn't that be nice? You know? There's no real person there whose reputation I need to be, you know, so crazy about. Yes, there is a dependently existent person. But because we exist dependently, everything about us can change. But if we think that we're independent, then we get so self-protective. Yeah. We see things as threats that aren't threats. Okay? Whereas when we can see the emptiness, which comes from seeing the dependent nature, then our mind is much more open and receptive to everything in the universe, much more relaxed. And we cease the negative karma, then we cease all the polluted karma. Okay, so that's the three kinds of wisdom. When they talk about the perfection of wisdom as one of the bodhisattva's practices. So you can see that underlying all three kinds of wisdom, we need an intelligent mind that investigates things. We need some concentration to be able to deeply investigate. We need compassion and fortitude and tolerance and forgiveness. Yeah, these are all very important qualities to have to do the bodhisattva practice. So what we covered today is the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. Okay, so you're very fortunate here to have a center, and you have many guest teachers coming who you can learn from. So take advantage of that and learn from the teachers who come here. Yeah. If you're interested in what we do at the Abbey, we have an online learning program. And we also have all sorts of teachings and series of teachings online. If you take one of the brochures, you can find our web address and watch some of the videos or download the audios, listen to them, or read different things. Yeah. I invite you to please come and visit us. Yeah. And I want to thank you for the opportunity of today. I was asked to close a little bit early so that we could have a group photo. And any last autographs of books. With my sloppy handwriting. Okay, so let's just come back to our breath for a minute and we'll dedicate. So spend a moment really rejoicing at what we did together as individuals and as a group. So all the virtue we created, the positive intentions we had for what we were doing all day long, the kindness and compassion we generated, and the wisdom through listening to the Buddha's teachings. Let's rejoice at what we did individually and what the whole group here did together. And let's rejoice at all the goodness in the world, at all the kindness that anyone, anywhere is showing to other living beings. Because there's a lot of goodness. Let's rejoice in all of it. And then you can think of all that goodness as like a light at your heart chakra, a light in the center of your chest. And that radiates out, fills the room, fills the world. And think that the light of all that goodness, our own and others that we're rejoicing at, that as that light touches other living beings, it makes their own minds peaceful. It gives them wisdom and compassion. And then let's recite the dedication verses.
Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, that has not arisen, arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more.